As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I'm conspicuously absent from the Times Power 100 list. I need to have a word with that Aisling O'Connor. So mischievous of her. However, I'm lucky to be joined by my three favorite Times writers. It's Alison Rudd, it's Ollie Kay, and it's Ben Smith, who will sadly be departing us, so we won't talk any more about him. Well, let's start at the Etihad Stadium. Manchester City and Sunderland, 3-3 draw. Now, what struck me was, Ollie, I want to start with you, that at some point when they're 3-1 down, you kind of think that, all right, look, the title's over. The mind games or whatever explanation you want to use, or maybe it's that the Black Cats, given what happened the last time City played Sunderland, it's all coming together and it's all done. And then City get those two goals and come back to equalize, and it's 3-3, and there's a glimmer. And as we tape this, United have yet to play Blackburn Rovers. But is the glass half full or half empty? I mean, do the positives of that reaction outweigh the negatives of another two drop points?
No, not at all. It's not half empty. It's emptying. I don't see the glass being filled back up to the brim by those two late goals. I think anybody who would think that Manchester City would go, you know, that their players would go into that dressing room positive and excited and energised and all upbeat after the two late goals. I think they are underestimating the sort of dynamics of that squad. That they're a miserable lot at times when things aren't going well, and they've it was a bad result, and they knew it, and they knew that they'd squandered a big opportunity to put more pressure on United.
So why did they bother to come back and score those two goals?
Because they were hoping to get a fourth one, and a fourth one would have made a difference. But as I saw on Saturday, once they'd scored the second and third, you were looking for the momentum that would take them forward to try and get a fourth goal. And I think they had, 9-10 minutes, including stoppage time. And they never really looked like doing that. They never really threatened the fourth goal. Knowing what I do about that group of players and their mood at the moment, that the dressing room would have been a dark place afterwards. It wouldn't have been full of backslapping and excitement at the point gained. It would definitely be viewed as 2 points dropped.
Anybody disagree? You all embrace Ollie's negativity?
Oh, I think it definitely, the feeling at the end was, you know, bloody hell, we've blown it. I think it wasn't, thank God we got two goals and rescued a point. It was doom and gloom all around the place. You know, Mancini afterwards was very downbeat. And
Mancini gets like that because that's kind of his personality, isn't it?
I understand, but there was no, there was no rejoicing in the fact that, God, thank God we got two goals back and didn't lose at home. It was, as Ollie said, a bad result, and it's a damaging one as well.
But was it really that? Was it really the tell? Because I'm looking at the marks, Ben, that you gave
sets. Bring it on.
Both sets of players and the Man City players. It's as you would expect, but you gave incredibly high marks to the Sunderland players.
Sunderland were fantastic.
Which implies it's not such a dreadful result. If you're facing a team that are playing the best, it sounds to me like that might have been very well the best Sunderland have played all season. And they've had some good performances. They go to the most difficult stadium at the moment to go to. They're on an unbeaten run, winning streak. They played really, really well. City are rattled a bit by this, but they pull it back to get a draw. I think you can make a case that's not bad. When Sunderland played so well.
I know, but no one looked at this game and thought, God, City will do well to get a point out of that. You know, I think Sunderland played as well as I've seen them all season. They were excellent. Sessegnon was brilliant.
How many shots on goal did Sunderland take in that game? As I make it, it's three shots on goal and three goals.
But there were...
So we can all celebrate the minimalism, but City also squandered a lot of... I'm not saying Sunderland played badly in this difficult situation, and they also had players missing and everything.
But to say they had three shots on goal and scored all three and that was it is a complete false representation of the game. They could have scored three goals in the first half. They could have scored three goals on top of the two they scored in the first half. In fact, they missed the target. Didn't make it not a good chance. Sunderland were excellent, and they were excellent from the first minute. Bettner had a volley cleared away by Riches in the third minute. You know, it was from the very start that Sunderland played well, but they were only allowed to play well because City looked inhibited. They looked nervous. The feeling in the stadium beforehand was, we can't blow this, and then that got onto the pitch. They weren't the City we know they have been this season.
Ollie, for better or worse, Mario Balotelli scores two goals. He gets into a row with Kolarov over who gets to take the free kick. He plays peacemaker on one occasion. And then, you know, he goes off the pitch grumpy. Kind of sums him up?
Yeah, it does. I mean, what doesn't necessarily sum his afternoon up is the fact that he scored twice. I thought from what I saw, which wasn't the whole game, it looked like he was... It looked like he was just having one of those all too frequent games where he just looks like he hasn't tuned in. You know, his brain isn't tuned in to playing football. He has those games quite often. Mancini said, you know, he would have taken him off after 5 minutes if he could. And, you know, he just seems to have those games. It's not every week, it's not every other game, but he has them far too often for a guy who, although he's young, should be better than that. I mean, he's so immature, he's so temperamental, and yes, he's got very good technique, and he's capable of very cool finishes, not least in the penalty spot, but he's... I think the bad outweighs the good with Balotelli. I think he's a liability.
Ben, you were at this game, so I'm assuming you've done your sleuthing and your homework. And I'm only going by media reports, so please correct me if I'm wrong here. Who is that the guy Sir Alex Ferguson planted, disguised as some kind of City physio, and poured acid on Sergio Aguero's foot? Who was it? Has he been found now?
He has not. He has not. Mancini's clearly...
It's not Jason Ferguson, is it?
Mancini's clearly furious about it. I mean, he...
So can you explain what happened for those who don't know?
Sergio Aguero damaged his foot. Somehow, we know that it was not playing with his child on a mini motorbike. That is not how it happened, because Mancini denied that. But we still do not know how the original injury
was. It was a spray, wasn't it?
Well, no,
it was confirmation of that.
Yeah, there was an injury to start with. It was then treated with this magical spray, or not so magical spray.
It's an anesthetic spray, I believe.
Yeah, which then there was an allergic reaction to that spray. Aguero's foot blistered, and that is what has kept him out of the matches. Mancini...
No evidence of foul play. One of the first things
Mancini,
getting in there.
No, Mancini isn't happy about it.
McLaren, perhaps. No?
we asked him...
Phil Brown, perhaps, tried to do an unsolicited favour to his friend.
No. We asked him, you know, was it Aguero's fault? No, it wasn't Aguero's fault. It's nothing to do with Aguero. It was not his fault. It was not his fault, he said.
So he spray himself.
We said, do you trust the club medical staff? He said, I only trust my personal doctor. At this point, Manchester City intervened to kind of prevent the line of questioning going any further. But the inference is that a mistake has been made by the medical staff, and Mancini's not happy with it.
I should point something out here for those who don't know, and sad Inter watchers will probably remember this. Mancini has had problems with club doctors throughout his career, certainly at Inter. He had an enormous falling out with the medical staff there, which got really, 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 really nasty, and really was probably at the heart of his decision to leave prematurely. So I from what you're saying, it doesn't seem like it's going down that same way. It's just kind of curious that this would happen. This would happen twice. He must already. Mancini's already quite a superstitious guy, so he's probably not too happy about this. Aston, should we talk some Sunderland? They had guys out. This wasn't a full side. But I want to start with Sessegnon. on paper, you would think he's not a typical O'Neill player. And yet, as he's been devastated. He's taken to the guy. Especially, and Sessegnon also had a reputation in France as being, you know, a bit of a nut job, too. You know, indisciplined, unpleasant, blah, blah, blah. But he was good under Bruce. He's better under O'Neill.
I don't know. This seems to be turning into the season of those sort of players who have intuition. I think that's probably the most... Maybe that is the mark of a good manager who can go into a team who look, they're probably not going to go down, but they're struggling. They're struggling, and they allow the players that are there to have confidence in their intuition. I don't know. I mean, you were there for the whole game. I only saw the highlights, but it seems to me he's someone who's intelligent and makes runs, intelligent runs. Yeah. In neat short passing, and yeah. You know, just very beautiful, intuitive player. And I think that does come from the manager saying, and he's done this with other players as well at the club. He's very good, O'Neill, at saying, I think you have it, express it.
He was fantastic playing in just behind Bentner, was given the freedom to drift left, to drift right. He created the first goal, breaking in from the left hand side, he created the second wide on the right. And the third, he picked up the ball in his own half and hit a 30-40 yard ball to Bentner, who laid it on for Larson. He did everything you'd want a player in that position to do. It was one of the best individual performances I've seen all season.
We like to compartmentalize people and see patterns and things like that. I was trying to think back to previous O'Neill sides, and I mean, getting sort of based on the description that Ben put forward of Sessegnon's role behind Bentner. Can you, as a seasoned O'Neill watcher of not quite Lansley-esque proportions, but still, I was trying to think. Can you think of other players that O'Neill has had who occupied that role, who had those characteristics? I mean, obviously thinking to Larson at Celtic, but then again, Larson was a different sort of player. He could do that, but he was just so much better than everybody else that he could do what he wanted. But it's not really something that in the past was sort of contemplated in an O'Neill lineup.
No, off the top of my head, nobody really springs to mind. I mean, I've always thought of him as a generally more of a sort of 4-4-2 type manager, and he's done well out of 4-4-2. And he's, I mean, similarly, you'd look at Bentner and you would say he's not really an O'Neill type player. He's certainly not an Emil Heskey type player, for better and occasionally for worse. But you know, he's just gone into that dressing room and looked at the players they've got and has found a way to win with them. I mean, you look at McLean, who's was sort of plucked from obscurity almost, from the reserve team, and he's he looks like a really, really good player, really effective Premier League player. And I mean, people like Catamol, Gardner, Sessegnon, obviously. I mean, they just suddenly look like a really good, decent O'Neill type team, and I don't know how much more he could get out of the players that he's got there. I think most of them are going full pelt at the moment, but I mean, isn't that a good thing? I mean, there aren't many mid-table teams who are going at full pelt at this time of season.
All right, from one Northeastern team emerging victorious against a largish Northwestern side to another. Newcastle 2-0 over Liverpool. I want to start out with something else, which, obviously as a guest in your country, I still have to put up with, it's creeping into our game. The foreigners brought it over. Roy Keane, one of my heroes, saying like, well, Balotelli, you can tell he's Italian. They like to do that, referring to diving and theatrics and play acting. And this season, I was making sort of a mental list of the most egregious incidents. And I also want to point out that, like, while running at a defender, sticking, leaving your leg behind and letting yourself fall at the slightest contact, that's all bad, right? But there's also really, really bad, which is diving like a complete moron, which is the way Andy Carroll does, who does it in a very stupid way as well. Throwing yourself to the ground like a little sissy, like the way Mr. Perch did. And I might add, earlier this season, Joey Barton, and especially Mark Tierney, of whom it was said he doesn't deserve to walk around with a shaved head and call himself a defender in the Premier League when you're going to be such an absolute wuss about it. Can we now? For once, agree that if you know we came to infect your game, your previously untarnished game, with our evil ways, we have now succeeded, and you are as fully diseased as we are. Ollie?
Yeah, totally agree.
I agree with that.
I think it's actually got to the stage now where it's instinct in a lot of cases. People will be going past the challenge. I couldn't quite see what happened with the Mark Davies one at Bolton.
That's another one. Yeah.
But
Mark Davies, of course, is from Argentina. No, Uruguay, better yet, right?
It just seems to be instinct now where people are going past a leg that doesn't even have to be sticking out. And they just, you know, they either try to hook their foot around it and fall down that way or whatever. I absolutely despise it. And it's probably very hard to turn the tide now unless the authorities enable something sort of retrospective. But I just absolutely despise it. And I despise the fact that you cheating foreigners have turned our game bad. Now,
yeah. Sue, we will teach you to cook and eat proper food as well. Alison, I mean, obviously the two incidents there in the game, right? Andy Carroll trying to win a penalty, and the other one that was bizarre because it was Perch who. Pepe Reina comes off his line, collects the ball. Perch looks like he gives him a little kick, maybe he doesn't, niggly stuff or whatever. Reina goes dementoid, turns, gets right in his face, puts his face right up against him. Now, Pepe Reina, obviously clever enough, knows all the dark arts because he's another foreigner himself, that he's not really going to go and headbutt, you know, James Perch in that situation because he doesn't want to be banned. But he puts his face very close to his, and Perch just kind of grabs his face and, delayed reaction, chucks himself to the ground. Can we actually rate which is worse? Because I would actually argue that Andy Carroll's an idiot for what he did, but it was actually very easy to spot, I thought, and the referee correctly booked him for diving, and hopefully should realize that a man his size cannot dive in that way and think he's going to get away with it. He's just not graceful and coordinated enough to do that. But the other guy, Perch, I mean, you're named, what are you trying to do? Are you just trying to get somebody sent off late in a game that you're already winning 2-0? For what?
I would have thought most people would say Perch's actions were the most despicable of the two. Because the Andy Carroll thing, it's complicated. He's going back to the club where, and they're booing him, and it's where he was once very happy, and he's not a happy striker anymore, and he's trying to prove stuff. And I imagine a lot of stuff was going through his head at that moment, and it may not have been that he consciously thought, I'm going to dive now. I don't think he was in a good place, and he made the wrong decision. So I think that's a complicated thing. With Perch, I think that's completely clear, and there are no complications. He just behaved like a cheat. He thought, woohoo, someone's put their head near my head. I can just fall to the ground, get someone sent off, and I'll be a hero with my mates. Well, no, you won't. I mean, I hope he's deeply embarrassed today. And I thought it was interesting that Reina was, obviously he was cross with Perch's reaction and incredulous, and he didn't get cross with the referee. He realised the referee had been duped and it wasn't the referee's fault, and he didn't lose it there. He just thought, I can't believe this has happened. That was definitely the worst action of the day.
Unfortunately, I think Reina did deserve a red card. I think as soon as you go to put your head towards someone these days, even if you don't make contact, the word intent gets you, and I think referees send you off because of that.
Unless, of course, it's your teammate, as in the Wolves game, in which case, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. I think Perch, you could argue Perch could have been sent off. First for tripping Reina, and then secondly for diving himself. I mean, I think what stuns me is that these footballers, Andy Carroll included, don't realise that they're going to get shown up for being fools and cheats instantly by television replays. I mean, I don't get it. How do you not know that you're going to look like an idiot? I mean, Perch was, it was despicable. It was the worst kind of thing we've got in this game, and it was nothing but cheating. It was a pure cheat.
Ollie, another bad result for Liverpool. If we had more than our usual quota of Liverpool fans here, they would point out that it would have been a completely different game if Simpson had been sent off for that handball on the line, and you would have had a penalty and all that jazz, and it would have changed the complexion of the match and whatever. All that might be true, and
I think it probably was a pen, but then again, it was really, really difficult to spot. Is that a valid excuse?
I don't know if it's an excuse. It's an explanation, and it is true that Liverpool did start the game very well, and you know, Carroll, I think, should have scored from the opportunity where he got around the keeper and mysteriously fell down. They should have had a penalty, and then they fell behind very soon afterwards. And you know, I wouldn't judge them on their, but I wouldn't judge them on their performance in the first 20 minutes. I would judge them in their, you know, on their reaction to falling 1-0 behind, which was just awful. It was so lacklustre. It was just a heartless, brainless display in the end. And although they had the odd, you know, they had decent moves at times. They seemed to compete well at times, but there was just, you know, poor decision making, lack of real desperate effort at times, and it ended up, having started well, being a very poor performance and a very worrying performance for Liverpool.
But I want to turn to Newcastle. We've praised them for much of the season for what they've achieved, and again, for those keeping score at home, I want to point out that their central defensive partnership was indeed the aforementioned Perch and Mr. Williamson at the back. Two guys I think would be, you know, maybe number five or number six on in terms of center half of most Premier League sides. Of course, no Coloccini, no Taylor. And at left back, I think they had Jonas Gutierrez, which, again, not really his role. But I'm wondering, going forward, how do they build on this? Because obviously they've got a very useful team together. They're going to have injured guys coming back. Do you get the sense that Ashley, who's lost so much money, thinks, all right, like, we got the good place. Look, I can make money from, you know, selling Tiote or selling this guy and whatever else. Is that going to be his temptation, or do you think he...
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
He really wants to start thinking in terms of top four and is ready to put the further investment in there.
I don't believe he's thinking top four. I don't think for a second he's thinking top four. His plan is certainly, having spoken to people at Newcastle, high up people at Newcastle earlier this season, their plan was always to buy them cheap, allow them to grow and play at Newcastle, and sell them on for a profit. And I think we'll see that this summer. I think Demba Ba will go. I think Tiote will probably go. I think if they get good offers on their top players, they'll sell them. And I think they'll try to bring in players to replace them at a very, very cheaply, as they did last summer.
I want to get your take on this, and also kind of ask, because we've had this come up before. Ashley has lost money, a lot of money, on this team year after year, despite, you know, selling players at a profit year after year, certainly over the last, I think, three fiscal years. Would Newcastle really be attractive to a buyer? I mean, obviously great support and whatever else, but if Ashley can't make money off them, even with the team doing so well, and I think this year they may break even or make a small profit, but that's sort of a confluence of freak events, starting with the Carroll sale and then doing so well this season. I mean, I'll put it this way. If you had a lot of money, are Newcastle the club you would buy?
I mean, Newcastle are an appealing proposition. I mean, it's a one-club city. They get... You know, what was acquired yesterday? 50-odd thousand, 52,000.
Right, can you squeeze more money out of those fans? Because those fans have been so loyal. They buy all the merchandise. They all go to the stadium. What are you going to do, like, to make more money? Raise ticket prices? Sell the naming rights? Look, he's already done that.
Giving them away to his own company. But Champions League qualification would make such a difference. But if we accept that, you know, they're probably going to fall a little bit short of that this season. And this season, I think the bar has been far lower in terms of a top four finish than perhaps it has been in the past. Because I don't think there are four top teams in the Premier League, or there haven't been this season. I think that the standard has been very low at times. It shows the difficulty in actually trying to finish fourth. I mean, it would cost an absolute fortune to build a team and build a squad that would be expected to do better than Newcastle have done this season. Obviously, it would be good for Newcastle if any departures are kept to a minimum and they can build on what they've got and they can add more quality because their scouting is brilliant. But it's very difficult to think that without putting huge amounts of money in, they could really improve.
Big moves afoot once again at the Football Association. They've created a new post of technical director, and there's this new National Football Centre in Burton-on-Trent. I just want to ask you and we've heard in the past from Peter Lanzi on this, but I want to ask you, what would you like this thing to do? Best case scenario, Ollie, I'm going to start with you. If you were hired as a mega consultant, £550 an hour, to the Football Association, and they said, all right, give me three things that this National Football Centre must do for it to be a success, what would you say? And we're not going to pay you £550 an hour, by the way.
What people always say when this thing is brought up, they always say, oh, you know, about time, we're going to have our Clairefontaine, we're going to be developing, you know, it's going to be a place to develop top-class players. And it's not that at all. Players are not going to be developed there. Players are going to remain at their clubs, and it's going to be the academy system it's been for the last 12, 13 years, whatever.
So what do they need all those 16 pitches for, however many there are?
It's for the use of the national teams when they're there. But the main thing about the National Football Centre is that it will be about coach education. And while that is not very sexy and it will take years and years and years to bear any fruit, I think most people would agree, I think everybody would agree, in fact, that coach education is something that English football hasn't been terribly
okay,
good.
Okay, so I take it that's one of your three things, yes?
Well,
a place where you can educate and school coaches into becoming better coaches. What are the other two?
Ideally, you'd want the players to be developed there in some way, but that's not going to happen. And you'd look for some kind of, I guess, sports science development, because that's another sort of facet of it, or, you know, find ways to be more innovative than English football has been in the past, rather than borrowing from other countries 5 or 10 years after other countries have worked these things out.
Anybody have any better suggestions or alternative suggestions or perhaps auxiliary suggestions to Ollie's one, which I think is the most obvious one, but also the most important one, which is just have a place where you can teach people how to coach and coordinate the various coaching licenses?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Yeah, no one would disagree that teaching coaches to be better coaches is a good thing, but I would be slightly concerned that because there are these pristine pitches at the centre that you invite the people who are already considered to be decent coaches, and there's an elitism about it, and you just take through the cream of coaching around the country, when in fact what really matters is that everyone should be piped through and have a chance to go, even if they're just level one and starting out. It's not going to be used by the national team very often, so you've got 12 hours a day, and if it's floodlit, you've got more than that. You sort of make everyone who coaches football feel important enough because they get a chance to go.
To eventually help an England team somewhere down the line, you've got to have the best possible coaches teaching our kids from the minute they start playing the game.
Yeah, but
and so that they
isn't
are,
there a natural selection process?
Yeah,
I mean, isn't this kind of the heart of the matter, right? I mean, let's face it, the people who are going to play for England one day, they all... The 12-year-olds are going to grow up to be England players one day, presumably all play for no more than
1,000 clubs in the country, or schools, or whatever. So the really rubbish ones Alison's talking about, they will never play for England. So do we, and I don't just mean England men's, I mean like girls as well and whatever else, but is there a point in...
No, the point is you then don't lose all the kids who are good but are lost to the game because they're not in a place where they're coached well.
Ollie, when news of this came out, news that they're going to appoint a technical director, I was very disturbed by the words of one FA official who I actually consider to be one of the good guys and one of the intelligent people. And no, I'm not referring to Alex Horn, where he came out and he said two things. And I mean, I wrote about this next week, but I'd love to go over with you again, where he talked about, you know, sort of Spain and Germany. And when they appointed Matias Sammer and Fernando Hierro, they had technical directors and look how well they've done. But most of all, this idea that all the youth teams should be playing the same way, and that England at all levels, men's and I presume women's too, should have a very clear philosophy based on retaining the ball and whatnot. And I thought this was just silly. The process in Spain and Germany began a long time ago, nothing to do with Matias Sammer and Fernando Hierro. In Germany, it began, you know, sort of 1998 to 2000. It began with an academy system, which is actually what you have here. And they don't just teach people to play a certain way. They actually teach players tactical flexibility, familiarity with all sorts of systems. And they leave it up to the coaches at each level, a youth level and a club level, to teach what system they think is best based on the kids that they have. The other absurdity is this obsession with possession and ball retention. Yeah, it works now. It works very well for Barcelona and for Spain, but hasn't always been that way. I mean, 10 years ago, it was a different situation. And why play possession when maybe you're better suited to play a different style of football? Were you as disturbed by those words as I clearly was?
I wasn't as disturbed by it as you were. No, I would say that the implementation of some kind of long-term philosophy about English football is very long overdue. I know, you know, it shouldn't be set in stone. There should
but
be
didn't Howard Wilkinson do this, and well, that's yeah, how we end up in the academy system.
And Charles Hughes and position of maximum opportunity.
No, we mark okay, but to be fair to Howard Wilkinson, I mean, he's not Pep Guardiola, but lumping him together with Charles Hughes, and I know he gets lampooned as some kind of dinosaur, but he's not quite like that. I mean, a lot of good things came out of his white paper, right? Or am I totally wrong on this?
I think that was a sort of very first step towards an overhaul of youth development in this country, and that was in 1998. And you know, there were various problems and flaws in it, according to people at various clubs, in terms of access to players and number of hours and you know, this 90-minute rule, etc. It's taken until now, you know, 2012, for them to get onto the next stage, which is this elite player performance plan, which the Premier League have introduced, and there are some unhealthy aspects, I think, to that as well. So I don't think that's the ultimate answer as far as everything is concerned. But what is very important is that England have some kind of belief and philosophy about what they're trying to do, what they're trying to achieve on a football pitch. If you look at the history of the England team, or the recent history of the England team, it's, you know, whenever a new manager comes in, it's starting from scratch. And you look at somebody, you know, Germany, Holland, wherever, there's more of a sort of long-term evolutionary feel to that. I mean, Aragonés quit after Euro 2008, Del Bosque came in, and it was pretty seamless. You know, you look at Löw taking over from Klinsmann, and whoever will ultimately take over from Löw, there is a sort of long-term philosophy there, and you don't see this sort of boom and bust and ups and downs that you see with the England team. It's about creating that kind of thing, which, you know, and the education of players and the education of coaches is central to that.
The other thing you need then at St. George's Park is a laboratory where you try and discover what is the English game. What, I mean, it's still vague, Ollie, isn't it? What is it? What does make the English game? What bits of the English game are successful that we should be imparting and to have this seamless transition for the next 50 years of success that we're going to have because we know who we are? We don't know who we are yet, do we?
English game is loss of nerve and penalty shootouts. It's bad diving.
but seriously, we've had a crisis of confidence, I think, on the international stage in some ways. I think we feel technically inferior, which we're no doubt we are, but we have felt that we needed to try and copy the rest of the world at a game they have long since perfected and that we're always be trying to catch up.
And that's why Gab's put on. We can't suddenly become Spain. And we're not Spain.
By the time there's any chance of catching up with Spain, Spain will be on to the next thing, and they'll be better at it than us. So why doesn't England work on the things that they are good at? I mean, you look at the success, the most recent success of the national team, probably back in Euro '96. They weren't playing tiki taka. They weren't playing this patient possession game. There was speed. There was crosses from out wide. There was everything that was good about English football right in that team. And since then, we've moved away from that. I still don't know why, and I still don't know why there is a feeling that we need to copy the best European team to try and make ourselves better. It's not going to work.
I think what you copy are the what is worth copying, and I think coach education is the single biggest thing. Coaching academies that work, and I actually look at Holland as an example. There's actually a very wide variety. People talk about the typical Dutch manager. Yeah, no, it's not just Louis van Gaal and Johan Cruyff and all this total football and all this rubbish. It's also Guus Hiddink. It's also Bert van Marwijk, who can be much more tactical, much more direct, much more 8-1-1 on occasion. And in Holland, it's because, like in Italy and indeed like in France as well, you see a wide variety of coaches emerge because when you go there, you actually taught every system as a coach, and you know you kind of pick the one that you're most comfortable with that matches your philosophy or that manages the kids you're working with. I think that is the single most important thing, and I think that's where England actually lags way behind. There's no explanation about why, as a nation, you guys produce on balance so many terrible coaches and managers. You know, you certainly don't punch your weight at that level. But beyond that, the development of the players is, I don't know, I mean, Danny Welbeck, is he technically that much worse than some of these guys at Sunderland? I mean, I know Joe Allen, like, is, I mean, obviously he's Welsh, but is he such a poor footballer that he would embarrass you on the England stage? So I think getting the technical guys in, I mean, I think that's happened. I think maybe what's necessary is a better tactical vision and players who are that little bit more professional, and although great strides have already been made there, and you know, a more consistent pipeline of creative, intelligent coaches.
All right, enough of that. Time for some quick hits. Ben, you're leaving us, so you get the first question. Fernando Torres scores his first league goal since September as Chelsea pummel Aston Villa. Two quick ones for you. Are you ready to say he's turned the corner? And will Villa get sucked into the relegation battle?
I think there are signs he's not far off turning the corner. The confidence is back. He's clearly a very different player. He hasn't got the pace he once had, but he's learning how to play differently. So, yes, I would expect him to score more goals before the end of the season. Villa, they do look like they're suddenly in a bit of trouble. Teams below them are winning. I think they're only 4 points clear of Bolton now. So, yes, I think they will get sucked into the relegation battle.
Uh-oh. Everton quietly win again. Ollie, why is Davy Moyes' team seemingly getting better as the season wears on?
Well, it seems to be what they always do. It's the same pattern as every season. But I think this season the situation was slightly different in that they had a very difficult summer, didn't manage to make the additions that they wanted to their squad, lost Arteta and lost others, and the confidence was very low. Then they made some very good transfer business in January, Gibson, Pienaar, Jelovic, etc. And I think finally, in the second half of the season, they've got some momentum, and I think that's a big factor.
Wow, prepare for them perhaps finishing above Liverpool. Spurs beat Swansea 2-1 and now remain on track for top four finish. Alison, should Spurs fans be happy or should they fear all this uncertainty in their future, what with Redknapp, Adebayor, Modric and all that good stuff?
If they don't finish in the top four, then they should be worried. If they stay in the top four, I think momentum will will mean they can carry on regardless. If Fred Knapp leaves, then they'll attract a really great manager who will have all these wonderful players at his disposal who won't want to leave, and everyone, there'll be a fantastic atmosphere. It'll be fine. If they finish outside the top four and they lose their manager, and they have a history of players who are always banging on about wanting to be in the Champions League, IWO will go back to City. They need to stay. They need to get Champions League football for it to be a happy place, I think.
Oh, raining on Spurs' parade there. Huge win for QPR as they defeat Arsenal. Ben, can you give a rational explanation for why they can beat Liverpool, Arsenal and Chelsea but still struggle near the foot of the table? And are they going to stay up?
There isn't a rational explanation, really. I suppose you could look at it. All those games have been at home. They play very well at Loftus Road. When the atmosphere's there, the crowd is so close to the pitch, I think it drives them on, and they produce results against the big teams because they have players who tend to rise to those occasions. Their running is... I know it's against big teams, and that might mean they lift their game and they play well and get points, but I just can't see them staying up. Just can't see it.
It was a relegation six-pointer at Molineux, and as Bolton duly dispatched Wolves. But, Ollie, it was also a bit of a freak show, what with Hennessy and Johnson getting into it, and Wolves being forced to play some guy named David Davis, who I actually thought was the guy who wanted to be Tory leader, but instead is some kid from the youth team who was playing for Chesterfield, bottom of League One, earlier this year. So let's lay off of Terry Connor, but seriously, was this a game that Bolton won or a game that Wolves lost?
Can it not be both? I thought Bolton deserve a lot of credit for the way they played and the way that they've sort of rediscovered their momentum over. I mean, that's three wins on the spin now, and they look confident at just the right time, whereas Wolves look anxious and fractious and doomed, really. They just look like a team who know they're going down, and looking at a table, you'd have to agree with that.
Alison, there was also a win for your old pal Roberto Martinez, or Martinez, as some people who've never been abroad like to call him. Can Wigan stay up, and should Martinez, move on to a bigger job regardless?
I'll call him Bobby. I've got money on Wigan staying up, so yes, they will stay up. I quite like Bobby's loyalty at Wigan, and if they stay up, which they will, I don't see why he shouldn't have another season where he actually tries to. I mean, you know, it went wrong. It's another relegation fight, and it'll all be marvellous if they stay up. And last season when they did, it was very emotional and beautiful. I think he should have another season where he tries to make them do more than just struggle. I think he should try and aim for top half of the table. And he called it a long term plan when he started. And I think he'd want to give it another year to prove that it's more than just that little battle at the end all the time.
I think you'll find long-term in football is 3 years, Alison. We've been there. He's done that. Time for him to move on.
One more season.
This will all be discussed in an interview with him in the Times later this week.
What? An interview by you?
An interview by me. Fantastic. Already done.
Giorgio Canalia passed away on Sunday. You knew him well, Gab. What will be his legacy?
Well, I think it's this incredible, larger than life character. I know it's an often overused term, but you're talking about a guy who made history in Serie A, leading Lazio to their first ever title. Who was this huge personality, a colorful Lazio side with their guns and their airplanes and constantly getting into fights. And you know, this guy who had the temerity at a World Cup to give his manager the finger when he walked off the pitch, but also an incredibly generous man who then later went on to go to New York Cosmos when he was really still at the peak of his career, becoming the all-time leading goal scorer in the old North American Soccer League. You can see film Once in a Lifetime, and you can tell you a little bit what the craziness was like, him playing with Pele, with Carlos Alberto. The guy who came back had a long career in the media, was president of Lazio, had legal issues, major ones later. I just know him as somebody I talked to a couple times a month, somebody I'd worked with, somebody who was always very, very generous of his time with me, and that's what I'm really going to miss. That's all we've got time for this week. But remember, you can go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, your web chats. Ollie, when's your web chat?
Wednesday. Wednesday lunchtime.
My web chat is on Tuesdays, Ben. Your web chat is never, or if you do have one, it'll be at another media organization. So we don't care about that because, of course, in case you haven't heard the news, Ben Smith is leaving us. We are very sad to see him go, and I will be having a chat with him in a bonus podcast. So make sure you download that as well. We're all on Twitter, but you already knew that. Till next week. Bye-bye.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.